I was thinking, all right, I don't want to just work in the for-profit space. I want to find a way to work in the nonprofit space. And I didn't really know how to go about doing that. And I ran into Idealist Consulting. And the first thing that caught my eye was the name. And I thought, Idealist, that is right up my alley. That is exactly where I want to be.
That is Michael Smith, a lead member of technical staff over at Salesforce.org. I'm Josh Burke, a developer evangelist for Salesforce, and here on the Salesforce Developer Podcast, you'll hear stories and insights from developers for developers. Today, we sit down with Michael and talk about the history, development cycle, and new features of the Nonprofit Success Pack. But first, we asked Michael about how he got into the Salesforce ecosystem.
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. So that goes back to about 2001, and at the time, I was managing all the systems we had at the small management consulting company. So basement data center, and we had all sorts of things running, and DOS apps and Lotus Notes and the like. And we didn't really have anything that we were using for managing our sales cycles. You know, we had some DOS stuff, but we needed something to deal with a remote workforce. Most of our salespeople were spread out across the country, the world for that matter. And a consultant that the CEO had hired came in and said, you know, there's this new thing called Salesforce.com. And it was brand new because it was 2001.
Yeah.
And I said, why don't you check this out? And I just thought it was the greatest thing since sliced bread. And so, you know, we managed to get that implemented. I'm not going to take credit for making the final choice. but I was right there going, yes, let's do this.
And, right.
And we just ran with it. And we continued to remember that there are still a customer today. And, you know, global, I mean, you know, if you go back to that, to those days, a lot of people didn't even have internet access. You know, we had to make sure this worked for dial-up.
Right.
It was, you know, it was a very different era. And anyone who used Salesforce back in the 2001, let's say, to 2004 timeframe remembers that was just pure HTML. It was, you know, very simple, but very powerful. The things that you could do on that platform were just amazing. I mean, it would have taken so much more effort to create a custom field in some other app. But here I could just zap it up on a website and we were done. It was amazing.
Yes. Yeah, so I want to talk current state a little bit, but I want to dig into that a little bit more. Like, like what's like the first, because I think a lot of, especially newer developers, maybe don't have an appreciation for what the size and scope of the platform was back then. So like, like what was the first thing you remember really building on the Salesforce platform?
Ooh, I think in, well, the early years, you know, we probably were mostly keeping it pretty simple. I think what sort of changed everything was in 2004, I went to Dreamforce, which was significantly smaller. I think everybody gathered in one room for like a cocktail hour. Everybody.
Right, right.
And it was no big deal. But at that event, a few things happened. One of them was that I started to learn more about the API. And that really opened up the door for me as the possibilities. And I, you know, got to see what other customers were doing. And so I came back with a ton of ideas. And the other thing that, which we'll get into later, I'm sure that came out of this was that I discovered the foundation, and the support for nonprofits. And that led to a whole other set of stuff, which is why I'm where I am now.
Right.
But yeah, when I came back from that event, I, you know, immediately got us, I think we were on Professional Edition when we started. I had us moved up to Enterprise and I started writing integrations. I think at that point we had a SQL Server and Oracle database for a bit of financials and some other stuff. And so I wrote some integrations using the old Excel connector. I took not the actual Excel itself, but I actually took the VB script that was in that and then used that to build an integration to move data from SQL and DOS into Salesforce so that I could produce reports in Salesforce that represented data that would have otherwise been local in our network only and not available to all the people that weren't actually in the office.
Gotcha.
And so that was the first big thing I built was this integration and then all the dashboards and reports that went with it.
Got it. I'm going to ask a question and you can plead the fifth if you like. did you ever create an S control?
I did write S controls because there was no Apex.
There was no Apex. People forget this. Like it wasn't like that you wanted to. Like S controls used to be the way that you had to integrate back to the platform, right?
Right.
Yeah. You predate me by about a year or so. My first real gig on the platform was actually debugging S controls. Ooh. And it was and so that mountain of JavaScript that was embedded in those things, like it was my job to run through and figure out which line was like misbehaving. So when we deprecated those, I was a very, very happy developer.
Yeah. Yes, I'm happy to see that they are no longer in existence.
Yes, yes. Okay, so now you were a Salesforce consultant for 8 years. In fact, your Twitter handle calls back to your consultancy, right? Force2be.
Sure does.
Okay. And was that like an individual consultancy or was it like a shop with employees? What was the scope of that?
It was just me. Mm-hmm. You know, at the time, there was a recession, and so I was off on my own. Mm. And I decided, well, I love Salesforce. Salesforce was growing. Like if you look back, the 2008, 2009 timeframe is a real jump for Salesforce in the community side in particular. But Apex, VisualForce had just started up. I think it went GA in 2008, if I'm not mistaken.
Sounds about right.
And so all the doors were starting to open, right? You could see the writing on the wall that Salesforce was moving from the CRM to the platform. And and I will say that I got lucky and made a good decision at the time that, you know what, I think this is what I want to do.
Right.
And so I ran with it.
Nice. Yeah, I keep saying platform as if that was the thing that was talked about even since all the way back to 2001. But I think I go back to Dave Carroll's reminiscing of the first quote-unquote dev zone, which I believe he described at a Dreamforce as a single table that he couldn't remember if it was poorly lit or not.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me. Yeah, there wasn't much of a dev zone back in the early,
Yeah. Now, how old is Salesforce.org? Like, I hadn't actually thought about that in the early days of Dreamforce, that was something that was going to be around.
Yeah. Well, Salesforce.org itself, right, that name is not that old. I think it's 6 or 7 years old at this point. But it is the former foundation. So the foundation existed from the early days. Everyone's heard Mark talk about the 1-1-1 model.
Right.
And so that was something he started when he started Salesforce.com, and that of course led to the foundation, which is what was handling the process of donating licenses in particular, but among other things, but licenses is the big one, to qualified 501c3s and education institutions as well. And so at I think around 2013, 2014, Salesforce Foundation became Salesforce.org.
Got it.
It kind of became that. And then Salesforce.org was independent for the most part from Salesforce.com until last year.
Right.
And now we are part of Salesforce.com, but we still call ourselves Salesforce.org.
Gotcha. And before we kind of get into nonprofits and .org, back to those years though, I mean, 8 years is a pretty impressive haul, especially as an individual consultant. Do you have like any kind of just words of advice for somebody who's maybe considering doing that same sort of thing in this day and age?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I mean, I loved doing it because I got to do so many different things. I tried not to take anything that was long-term full-time. So my goal was always to have a fairly well diversified set of customers so that, you know, in a given week or a given month, I could be working on a nonprofit or for a bank or whatever, doing different things. And so it kept my skill set a little bit broad across the platform. And I enjoyed that. It kept me from getting bored.
Right.
And that was the key for me, was I don't want to get bored. And I knew people and I knew, you know, I was constantly getting calls from recruiters like, you know, we give you a 6-month project, you know, and you could work remotely, which of course back then was, wasn't as popular.
Right.
And I was like, no, I don't really want to do that because I do the same thing for 6 months. I like that I can do different things. It's just the way my brain works, I think, it's hard for me to just stay that focused for one thing. I get kind of itchy.
Nice. And then how did you end up at Salesforce.org?
Well, that was, you know, after working in the nonprofit space for quite a while, get to know people. I had done some beta testing of the Nonprofit Success Pack version 3 when it was being introduced. And so I actually was working with Kevin Bromer and Carlos, and I think even Nick at the time, just through the Power of Us Hub, doing beta testing and some other stuff. So, you know, I kind of get to know the people, and I knew Judy Son as well, who's been at the foundation a long time, and she's local to me. And so At some point, they were looking for a developer, and I guess my name came up, and someone reached out and said, hey, what would you think about coming and working for Salesforce.org and actually building the product?
Nice.
As opposed to implementing it. And I was like, sure, I'd love to do that.
Awesome. Okay. So on the pod, we talked previously a little bit about NPSP, but mostly when it comes to like the build systems, when we had Jason Lance on the mic. But let's level set for everybody. Mm. What is, so we, I think we've already mentioned it. What does NPSP stand for and what does it do?
Yeah. So NPSP stands for the Nonprofit Success Pack. And it is, we're going to call it a managed package. It's technically a collection of managed packages, but we'll say it is a managed package.
Okay.
That sort of customizes or puts a cell on top of Salesforce.com proper, right? The enterprise edition that gives nonprofits more functionality akin to their business. So a lot of stuff around fundraising, memberships, let's say in-kind gifts, some basic grant functionality. A lot of things around constituent management, so relationships and affiliations. Recurring donations is a big one. Gift entry is also something that, you know, we've kind of revamped over time as well. And, you know, so the huge things that a nonprofit would do as part of their daily business cycle, different than maybe what, you know, a company that was selling widgets would do.
Right. And I want to dig into that a little bit more, but first an asterisk on, because we're Salesforce and we like to rename things. And so clear this up for me, is NPSP now the nonprofit cloud or is NPSP part of the nonprofit cloud?
Great question. So yeah. you're gonna bring up the renaming. NPSP used to be the Nonprofit Starter Pack. It was renamed to the Nonprofit Success Pack. And it has become part of the Nonprofit Cloud, which consists of not just Nonprofit Success Pack, but also other products like Program Management Module, Case Management, Outbound Funds, Volunteers for Salesforce, Counting Subledger. So there's a whole bunch of things that sort of fall under the larger nonprofit cloud now. But yeah, and NPSP sort of probably still the flagship, being one of the oldest product that we have.
Got it. That's part. Oh, got it. Now, I think one of the interesting things about nonprofits is, like, first of all, I don't think people have, you know, necessarily an appreciation for the different kind of business model that it sort of is. I guess where I'm going with this is, like, we say customer relations management. NPSP is really constituent relation management. Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, constituent relationship. Yeah, you could look at it that way. Absolutely. I mean, among other things, absolutely.
And like, what's the distinction between a constituent and a customer?
Well, you kind of look at the your normal business model, right? Out for for profits that are using Salesforce, they tends to be. Let's look at accounts in context, right? So accounts will tend to be organizations, and the contacts are the people that work for those organizations. So it's a lot of B2B. And then when you look at the nonprofit model, particularly the Nonprofit Success Pack, and even when you look at EDA on the education side, it's a little bit different. It's not so much B2B. It's more B2C or even B2D, right? Business to donor. So the account is the household. The contact is the member of the household. And so that is sort of the model that we use. And so that constituent manager, you're dealing with the actual donor as the contact, the person, as opposed to a business which has employees that you may be working with. So that's probably the easiest way to distinguish those.
Gotcha. And is there an aspect to this where the nonprofits are also working with their volunteers?
Yes, absolutely. There's a Volunteers for Salesforce product that does a lot of that, and they've got all sorts of capabilities. And I think there's a newer version, but that's one where we may need to check.
Got it. And then when I was talking with Jason and also a little bit with Course Know about the open source sprints, we kind of described them a little bit, but I do think it bears repeating. What are the open source sprints and how do they delve into your development?
Great question. And I will give a plug. There's actually an open source sprint going on right now today. It is virtual.
Nice.
as are all things right now.
Right.
So the open source sprints started, I think the first one was like 2009. It was a way for the community to give back. And so when the Nonprofit Success Pack, I guess, first started up, and you know, my involvement in the early days is kind of limited. So I picked it up at what we call as version 3, which is the current version. And that was in like 2013 or somewhere around that time frame.
Okay.
But before that, it was open source in smaller packages. And so some of the other nonprofit partners out there had built some stuff, put it up on GitHub. Mm. That sort of merged its way. You could go early back to Steve Anderson, who actually had a template back when there was templates in Salesforce. And so, but it was all very much open source, kind of existed out there on the web for people to use and to expand upon. And so mm-hmm. the open source sprints were around in the early days where people in the community, whether they be customers or partners or whatever, to come in and help. Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, well, let's write some code, or let's create some object, or create some automation, and we'll just make it part of the package. Mm-hmm. And we'll include it in there. And so that's how they started out. And they've kind of grown and morphed since then, to the point in which they're quite large now. But the amount of incredible ideas that come out of our communities is really quite awe-inspiring.
So I want to follow up on that, but I think level setting really quickly, how much of NPSB is open source?
Well, the whole product mm-hmm. is in a public repository. So
got it.
Technically okay. speaking, 100% of it.
Pretty much all of it. Got it.
Yeah.
And then talking about what you just mentioned, like how much of the sprints are giving like new features and new ideas, and how much of it is like code quality and refactoring and making things better?
I would probably say it is 99.5% ideas and documentation and videos,
nice.
Maybe even specs. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been to more than a few open source sprints, and I'll be honest, I've barely written any code. I tend to have a lot of great conversations, come up with a lot of ideas. I document stuff.
Right.
That doesn't mean it doesn't happen. I think in the last one I went to, which was probably in Philadelphia, there was actually code being written. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, I forget whether we ended up merging that into master or not, but we did have some code around doing some additional work, I think, on engagement plans. So it does happen, but it's not as frequent, which is always a little, right? I think people always assume that, well, it's an open source sprint, so it must be a developer event, but it's not. It's really a community event for people to come together and share ideas, and for, everybody to benefit, for the nonprofits to benefit, the education institutions to benefit from each other and talking to one another. And then for us at Salesforce.org to benefit from listening to everybody, take mm-hmm. those ideas back and put that into our roadmaps.
Nice. Yeah. From my experiences with hackathons, I had always wanted to have somebody come up with a concept that was basically like an anti-hackathon, which was sort of like people coming together to actually have software become better and or produce for other people to actually use, which for me, a hackathon always feels like a bunch of people working on their own trying to come up with something cool that will never be used again. Yeah. And so when I heard about the open source sprints, I'm like, they did it. Like that's yeah. pretty much the closest that I've ever heard. And I think that's great because, I mean, NPSB is big and complicated, right? So this feels like a really good way to have that community feedback loop to keep it moving forward.
Yeah, totally. And I think Judy Son and her team just do an amazing job of coordinating those. And the fact that they were able to pivot to virtual and mm-hmm. have done it very successfully, it's really quite impressive.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty insightful that Jason Lance was like, we're always going to have a virtual aspect to it now. Like people are having too much fun being able to participate from all around the world, right?
It's true.
Yeah. Okay, so let's pivot that over to like internal sprints. What's the internal development more like?
Well, we're totally agile, so we follow your standard 2-week sprint plan. Mm-hmm. And we have a pretty consistent continuous delivery cycle. So we do release new versions every 2 weeks. Wow. At least at the nonprofit success pack, it does vary. We have a lot of products in our overall portfolio. So not everybody releases every 2 weeks, but mm-hmm. nonprofit success pack, the larger of the products, 2 scrum teams, 3 technically, I suppose. And we do, you know, we're continually merging into master every 2 weeks. We do a push. So on the Wednesday following the end of the sprint, we do a push to sandbox.org. That's about, and I'm sure Jason covered these incredible numbers. It's like 40,000 sandbox orgs. And then probably more like 60. And then the following Tuesday, we do a push to production orgs, and that's another 25,000 or so. So pretty big numbers that we're doing. Push upgrades too. And even though we're pushing every 2 weeks, we've sort of centered some of our bigger functionality around more formal releases. So we follow Salesforce.com's model now of a spring, summer, and winter release. So we just had a summer release, I think at the end of August. We've got a winter release coming up, and that'll have some new functionality in it. And we'll have, of course, have a spring release. But even though we've sort of centered on that for the larger functionality, we are still pushing out updates every 2 weeks, bug fixes, little changes, constantly iterating, constantly improving.
Gotcha. I think the scope of that is insane. And, Jason was talking about some of the mad science he's had to do in order to kind of keep that up and running. But the other dimension that I don't think people necessarily have an appreciation for is the scope of some of these nonprofits themselves. Like, I think a lot of people think of nonprofits as kind of small, scrappy organizations, but what do some of them look like on the larger end of the spectrum?
Yeah, there are some big ones. You know, you're right that, a lot of our nonprofits are smaller. Mm-hmm. Organizations, but the ones that are big, tens of millions of records. The couple of the numbers that have come across my plate recently are one particular organization that has 83 million opportunities, which is
wow,
kind of hard to fathom,
yeah.
but it exists.
Wow.
On the recurring donation side, which is a big project that we've been working on my Scrum team, mm-hmm. We've been looking at organizations that have, let's say, 500,000 to 750,000 recurring donations. So that's basically, a sustainer. So you think about donors that give every single month or every quarter, right? So these sustaining donors. So they've got that many, which means that every month, let's say, they're getting, 500,000 donations coming in just from those sustaining donors. That doesn't even count the one-offs. So if you look at that kind of volume, it's pretty big, pretty neat, actually.
So let's use that as a segue into some of these new features. Like, tell me a little bit more about like recurring donations, how they work, but also like how are you making sure that doesn't break for like 80 million opportunities?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So recurring donations is this concept of sustaining donors, and I'm sure everyone who's donated gets the prompt: would you like to make this a one-time gift, or would you like to donate every single month?
Mm-hmm.
That's a recurring donation, and so that is what recurring donations as a product does in the nonprofit success package. So the new version of that is called enhanced recurring donations, and it's got some extra automation and nice, beautiful Lightning Web component-based user interface.
Nice.
And the like. But it also has a completely redesigned, and I'm going to say architecturally beautiful, set of code underneath it. And so when we were looking at rebuilding that, particularly the nightly batch job, because that's where, when you're dealing with millions of records, mm-hmm. it's the nightly batch jobs, right? Anything like that that's got to loop through millions and millions of records where you're going to see performance. It's like saving a record isn't necessarily going to be a lot slower in those orgs, unless, of course, it's trying to do something crazy while it's saving a record. So on an individual one-off, you don't see that kind of performance. But it's the nightly, repetitive batch job stuff. And so we really worked very hard to try and streamline that to make sure that it was performing, best as it could. And so we use tools like the dev console to try and take a debug log and analyze that and just see what it's doing. I just went through this recently where I was actually looking to see, I am getting, I got a batch size of 1,000. I should expect to see a specific number of query rows and DML statements based on the actions that it's taking. So I'm looking to make sure there's not recursion. So if I see double the number of DML statements or rows, then I'm like, okay, or even statements, then maybe something extra is happening. Like there's a recursion which would be bad because that's going to take up extra time. So we really worked hard to make sure that was good. And then on the testing side, we created a sandbox org and we shoved 1 million recurring donations in it and set up the org and then ran the nightly job five times. You'd run it once, let it do its data. And so let's take the worst case scenario. So worst case scenario is that this nonprofit has everybody gives on the first of the month. So they've got 1 million sustaining donors. Every single one of them is on the first of the month. So that means on the first of the month is when this job is going to do the most work. It's basically going to create the next installment opportunity in the org. And so, we'd run that, let it create 1 million opportunities, time it, get all the data, delete all the records, do it again. And you just do that five times and then average the times together and then just make sure that, okay, well, you know, in a worst case scenario, if a nonprofit has 1 million recurring donations, this is how long
this is what it's going to look like
at its worst.
At its worst. So I think that's such a valuable lesson. And I learned it the hard way as a developer on a project one time that, and it was all through good intentions. Like, we kept going back to the client and being like, you need to give us a sample size that's similar to what you have in production. Yeah. And they gave me like 500 rows. And I'm like, I don't believe you. And they gave me like 50,000 rows. I'm like, okay, maybe that's a little bit closer. We'll work off of that. And then I can't remember what the final number, but they say put into production. They're like, this is taking 5 minutes to load. And I'm like, because you got like 5 million rows. Yeah. You forgot to mention this key detail. Right.
Yeah, just designing for scale is something that you know, I mean, when you're writing code for the org that you work for, mm-hmm. you know exactly what you're building for, so mm-hmm. you know what your scale is. But when you're writing a managed package, you don't know what that scale is. It could be anywhere from a few hundred rows to, well, 83 million. And so you know, but it's hard to build everything for scale, right? It's not an Oracle database,
right?
Directly, right? We, you know, I can't call it my friend the DBA and have him tweak an index for me.
Right.
But it's an incredibly powerful database. But you do have to write for scale, right? You have to plan for it. You know, there's chunking. There's all sorts of techniques you can use in writing for scale to make things work. And the, you know, platform continues to improve from that aspect.
Nice. So another feature that just rolled out is the accounting subledger. Describe that to me, and how does it kind of work?
Yeah. So the accounting subledger, I give my best explanation, is basically the ability to have transactions from the nonprofit success pack, mm-hmm. create journal entries that can be exported up to another system.
Okay.
And so, you know, it's particularly looking at the allocations object, and the payments object, and it's taking that information and it's converting that down into ledger entries. And then those ledger entries can be integrated in with, you know, some, typically external, but not always, mm-hmm. you know, financial system. So that's a pretty new product that they're continuing to expand upon. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty interesting to be able to, you know, look at, you know, allocation and payment data and then convert that down into ledger entries. And they've got to deal with scenarios like, you know, just reversals, right? So the donor gives and it were allocated and then they say, no, I didn't mean to do that. And then they've got to reverse that. So you got to create all those matching ledger entries. So it's pretty cool.
And what about Elevate? What is that and what are giving pages?
Yeah. Elevate. So Elevate is a new payment solution that we've introduced. That's a very exciting platform. And so giving pages is something where, let's say, a nonprofit can create a page on their website that anybody can go to and give and donate. And then the whole concept is that that transaction will go from, you know, that website, go through Elevate and go directly into the nonprofit success pack. So it will create the donor record, right? So the account and the contact, it'll create the opportunity and payment as the donation itself. Mm-hmm. And it'll flow through nicely. And so that is Elevate and giving pages, and that, you know, that payment solution and our ability to actually capture payments and allow nonprofits to set this up pretty quickly at competitive transactional rates is what I understand is really very cool. And that's continuing to improve. We are continually adding integrations from nonprofit success pack to Elevate and vice versa. And so, look for that to be in every release.
Got it. So, you know, 2 week sprints, 3 RR. A lot of different features coming up. What are some of your strategies around refactoring to keep the quality of the stuff up and running?
Good question. Yeah, Nonprofit Success Pack is an older product, right? I think it's been around for a long time. It's gone through a lot of iterations, and anybody who's written code knows that if you look back at code you wrote even last year, you'll tend to think, what was I thinking at the time? Right. So, you know, when you've got code that's existed in some cases for 10 years, you look back at that, you think the same way. So that, you know, amongst just other, you know, how stuff gets built, particularly if you're bringing things in from the community or from other sources. Like I said, it was built from, across other partners and stuff. So
right.
The point of all that is we are looking at them. We do take it very seriously. So, you know, one thing, you know, we're starting up a new project now to really start looking at a couple of areas of the nonprofit success pack and, you know, get an understanding, you know, what is it they're doing and, you know, what should they do? And so, you know, we're going to rebuild those, you know, just following all the proper ways, the things we would do now. So test driven development, you know, we certainly use all clean code methodology in anything we build. We have a lot of, hope to be able to properly use, stubs and mocking, and dependency injection to allow for much more discrete unit testing. You know, anyone that's written on the platform probably knows, well, you know, you write a unit test, you insert some data, you let the triggers run and you see what happens. And that's how we all used to write unit tests back in the day. But again, in scale, that becomes problematic. And so, we want much better tests. So we're slowly, but, surely starting to work on that. We're literally just starting up a new one right now where we're going about, you know, refactoring a couple of significant areas. And like I said, we just rebuilt recurring donations, and as enhanced recurring donations. And that is a complete rebuild from scratch. Every line of code in enhanced recurring donations is brand new.
So that's interesting. Like what do you think is a good turning point to go and say, we can actually just rewrite this and it can be a better feature overall?
It's a tough one. Like, part of me says, well, just always rewrite, right? Figure out what it does.
Right.
And, you know, map it out, like, you know, exactly what it does and then just rebuild it and make it better. But the practicalities of that are that may not always work. And so, there is a balance. You know, I think it's not Fowler. Maybe it's Martin that has a book on refactoring and he talks about a lot of these methodologies. So, I don't know if there's a single answer to it as much as you kind of have to look at the landscape of it. You know, what are we dealing with here? Is this a class? Is this 10 classes? You know, and then of course, how thick is the spaghetti? Because that's always the thing is you're looking at code like that and it's got fingers into everywhere. And so little, you know, whole bunch of public static methods that every single other class and other places call into. Well, that's a lot harder to refactor. It's not a discrete unit that you can just maybe, let's say, rebuild. So, it's difficult. I think, you know, as we start to work on the new work, we're probably going to not start from scratch. We could get away with it with recurring donations because it was an entirely new discrete feature. And we wanted to rebuild everything and keep total, you know, code separation so that the customers that were still on legacy recurring donations would still function exactly as they do today with no impact. And the customers that migrate to enhanced recurring donations get a brand new code base. Everything is functional and they are not impacted by anything in legacy recurring donations. So
nice.
Totally separate.
Nice. I think that your phrase, how thick is the spaghetti? I feel like that's a good, like that's, I don't know what the right math is for that, but I feel like that's a really good value test, right? Okay. Are there any other new features of NPSP that you want to give a shout out to?
Gift entry is probably one. I think the work that's been done with gift entry and NPSP is really quite beautiful. It's totally customizable forms with this advanced mapping using custom metadata types. And, you know, that has been the basis for a lot of new work that that particular Scrum team is working on. And so I will give a shout out to the incredible work that's been done on that. It's really quite beautiful to look at.
And that's our show. Now, before we go, I have to say, the more I ask people about their non-technical hobbies, the more I want to go outside.
Mostly cycling, I would say.
Nice.
That's something I've been doing a really long time. And I continue to do even in the midst of the pandemic.
So I'm going to give you a follow-up question because I did see this on your Twitter profile, but what is your favorite beer?
There's so many, but I think I might have to stick with the classic Pliny the Elder.
A classic indeed, and definitely way up there in my top five as well. I want to thank Michael for the great conversation and the information. Of course, I want to thank you for listening. Now, if you want to learn more about this podcast, head on over to developer.salesforce.com/podcast, where you can hear old episodes, see the show notes, and have links to your favorite podcast service. Thanks again, and I'll talk to you next week.